Inevitably, as a result of some nations adopting Protestantism, the Catholic Church in the West increased its crusading fervor. Yet there was a sense in which also encouraged its own form of reformation, sometimes known as the Counter-Reformation, to remedy the fact that for centuries some areas of the Catholic Church had lacked a well-educated, well-trained, and moral priest and bishops. Now, we've chronicled in this class many times the immorality and lack of ethics that existed within the Catholic hierarchy. Okay? So, historians argue about whether or not these moves on the part of the Catholic Church are rightly called a counter-reformation or whether they are just a Catholic reformation. Okay? So depending on what books you read, the historians are going to argue back and forth as to what is really going on here during this time period as the church seeks to respond to the moves of Protestants. Some historians have interpreted the Catholic Reformation as a counterattack against Protestantism. Others have described it as a genuine revival of Catholic piety with few thoughts of Protestantism. The truth is the movement was both a counter-reformation, as Protestants insist, and a Catholic Reformation, as Catholics argue. Its roots run back to forces before Luther's time, but the form it took was largely determined by Protestant attack. Now, just think about Luther just for a second. When Luther first posted his 95 Theses to the door, we've talked about this already, was his original intention to make a new church?
No.
No. His original intention was to reform the Catholic Church. All right? Now, in that sense and in that regard, Luther was not the first guy to say that the Catholic Church needed to be reformed. Erasmus said that. Guys before Erasmus were saying that. So in that sense, Luther is not unique. And we've already studied how once it becomes apparent to Luther that the church is not going to reform, does he realize that he's going to have to leave it altogether and start something new? Okay? So the calls for reform within the Catholic Church were not something that were new with Luther. They had existed for a few generations previous to Luther. So if you're talking about this Catholic Reformation or Counter-Reformation, in a sense, it's both. It's a revival, if you will, if you want to use that term, from within the Catholic Church, but it's also a response to the Protestants and what the Protestants are doing at the time. Now, important leaders of the Catholic Reform Movement were Ignatius Loyola, who we'll talk about, who founded the Jesuits, and Popes Paul III and Paul IV, who took actions to reform and renew the church from within. Now, before we move on to point two, does anybody have any questions about the introduction? Okay. Early calls for reform. Strange as it may seem, the mystical experience was a large part of Catholicism's recovery. Even before Luther posted his theses on the church door, a distinguished and aristocratic group at Rome had formed a pious brotherhood called the Oratory of Divine Love. Their guiding belief was that the reformation of the church and society begins within the individual soul. So these guys, number one, they identify the fact that the Catholic Church has issues. But they say that the way that the issues of the Catholic Church and within the Catholicism are going to be addressed is by an individual revival in the souls of individual Catholics, is essentially what they're saying. I bring them up to highlight the point that before Luther, there were already these groups forming that identified that there were serious problems within the Catholic Church at the time. All right? The oratory was never large in number, perhaps at 50, yet it had enormous influence. It stimulated reform in the older monastic orders, such as the Augustinian monks and the Dominican monks, and contributed leaders to the Church of Rome as it laid plans for a general council to deal with internal reform and the Protestant heresy. Among the members of the oratory who later emerged as significant figures were a bunch of guys, this guy, Jacopio, whatever his name is, who debated with Calvin, Reginald Pole, who tried under Bloody Mary to return England back to Rome. And this guy, Gaian Petro Carapa, who became Pope Paul IV. So this oratory, it's a small group, but it's going to have a it's going to have a disproportionate influence. It's going to have a big influence within what is going on within the Catholic Church. So much so that three of its prominent members, one of them is going to debate with Calvin, the other one is going to try to, under the reign of Bloody Mary in England, return England back fully to Catholicism, and the other one is going to be one of these reforming, end up to be one of these reforming popes, Pope Paul IV. Okay? So this is going on before the time of Luther. Throughout the 1520s and 1530s, however, the Church of Rome took no significant steps forward. So while Protestantism under Luther and Zwingli and later Calvin is starting to charge full steam ahead, the church is kind of stuck in the mud, in a sense, spinning its tires. Okay, they're aware that there are issues, they're aware there are problems, they know that Protestantism is gaining steam and momentum, but yet for a while it seems as if they're really not able to do much about it except excommunicate Luther and, you know, try a few people at the Inquisition and burn them at the stake and that type of thing. But an organized, formal Catholic response to these guys does not really take hold in the 1520s or 30s. Now, obviously, that all raises the question of why. Why is it that way? Why is the Catholic Church slow in responding? Why was she so slow to respond to the Protestant challenge? And I'm just going to give you the simple answer is politics. Okay? As I've alluded to already in this study, and we discussed 2 weeks ago, the Emperor Charles V and the popes fought a running battle over the calling of a general council that stretched over 2 decades. Luther had called for a council of the church as early as 1518. The idea gained the support of the German princes and the emperor, but the popes had fears of such an assembly. Equally important, the popes in the 1520s and 1530s were preoccupied with secular and political affairs. Like I mentioned to you at the beginning of the lesson, the incursion of the Ottoman Muslims into Europe and the fall of Hungary and Eastern European countries to the Muslims. So no serious reform came until Pope Paul III ascended the papal throne. Paul then appointed 9 of the new cardinals to a reform commission. After a wide-ranging study of conditions in the Church of Rome, the commission issued in 1537 a formal report, Advice Concerning Reform of the Church. Disorder in the church, the report said, could be traced directly to the need for reform. The papal office was too secular. Both popes and cardinals needed to give more attention to spiritual matters and stop flirting with the world. Bribery in high places, abuses of indulgences, evasions of church law, prostitution in Rome, these and other offenses must cease. Okay? So, do they know that there's problems?
Yeah.
Anybody looking at the Catholic Church, whether you're Catholic or not, could see that things within the Catholic Church were not the way the Church was saying they should be. You follow what I'm saying? Okay? Now, again, are there any questions at this point? So Catholics are slow to respond. And the major reason they're slow is mostly politics. They have this, the popes are worried about the Muslim armies coming into Europe, and so they're really not responding to this, at least not at first. Third point this morning is the founding of the Jesuits. How many have ever heard of the Jesuits? Okay. The founding of the Jesuits is going to be a significant move on the part of the Catholics with far-reaching implications, as we'll see not only today but also next week. The Jesuit order, first called the Society of Jesus, was founded in 1534, and The Jesuit order, first called the Society of Jesus, founded in 1534, and 6 companions had its greatest impact upon the Catholic Church. Now, the founding of the Jesuits are going to be founded by Ignatius Loyola. Okay, Ignatius grew up in his father's castle in Loyola, Spain. The great turning point in his life came in 1521 when he was injured in war. While recovering, he thought about his past sins and about the life of Jesus. His daily devotions, he believed, cleansed his soul. In 1522, Ignatius began writing a book called Spiritual Exercises that laid out a day-by-day plan of meditation, prayer, and study. If you think about Ignatius, before the founding of the order, Loyola had lived an austere lifestyle of self-denial. Yet, like Luther, he was unable to find inner peace. Instead, he chose to obey the leaders of the church, and thus, in addition to taking the usual three vows of chastity, obedience, and poverty, Jesuits also vowed obedience to the Pope and to carry out whatever task the Pope might deem necessary. Okay? So, Loyola is going to have it's very interesting. He has a very similar experience to Luther, where he comes face to face with the fact of his own sinfulness and so forth, but he goes the exact opposite direction. Luther comes, after reading the book of Romans and lecturing on it at the school there in Wittenberg, to the realization that the just shall live by what? Faith, right? And that there is no self, that works don't save, and so on and so forth, and you know the rest of that story. Well, Loyola is going to come to a very similar situation where he is coming face to face with the fact of his own sinfulness, but he's going to go the direct opposite way and tie his eternal soul and salvation under not just the church, but in the swearing of an oath of obedience directly to the Pope. So all of the Jesuits then, as it says in that point, are going to not only take a vow of chastity, obedience, and poverty, but they're also going to swear an oath of allegiance and obedience to the Pope to carry out whatever task the Pope is going to deem necessary. Yeah?
Now, is that the name of the town and his last name?
Ignatius Loyola,
That's his last name, too.
It's a good question. I've had the same question when I was studying through this, and nothing I read answered that. I don't know, I don't know if it's like saying Ignatius of Loyola, and then it just got, Ignatius Loyola. Yeah.
I do genealogy. Most of our surnames, our last names, actually came from that, the town we were of, or the job that our forebear did.
Yeah, they talk like, they do in Lord of the Rings.
But weren't the towns normally named after the first family who settled there?
I haven't known yet, far enough to see that to begin with. But
in some cases, yeah. And then, now there's Catholic universities in this country, Loyola University, Loyola Marymount, all those are founded by who? By Jesuits. They're all Catholic universities. All right.
But originally, people didn't really have surnames. In various localities, they were just Joe the Plumber or whatever.
The idea that they had was not to create a new monastic order. The Jesuits are not going to be like the Augustinian monks or the Dominican monks or any of those old monkish orders that we've talked about in the past. Okay, that's not their goal. As a former soldier, Loyola naturally formed his society along military lines. The principal virtue for his members, who all were priests, was obedience to the general order and the Pope. The members did not have a particular rule to follow, but did have the spiritual exercises that Ignatius wrote as a guide to disciplined meditation. They were also rigorously selected and trained. Novices who trained for 2 years before becoming formed scholastics, a stage which could last up to 15 years before becoming full members. It was also after completing this arduous training that the new member would make the vow of total uncompromising obedience to the Pope. Okay? So, in a sense, the Jesuits are organized almost as a military force. Okay? And they are going to have very militaristic ideas and aspirations in the way they're going to handle things. Okay? But that is coming from Ignatius's background as a military guy. Alright? Now, in the summer of 1539, Loyola filed a petition of Pope Paul III to officially recognize the Jesuits and establish a new religious order. On September 27, 1540, the Pope issued a bull that formally, I like how they call that a bull myself, it's rather humorous. The Pope issued a bull that formally established the Society of Jesus. The specification of the bull outlined clearly what sort of society the Jesuits would be. Now this is a quote here from the bull, okay? It says, let all the members know and let it be, not only at the beginning of their profession, but let them think over it daily as long as they live, that the society as a whole and each of them owes obedience to our most holy Lord the Pope and the other Roman pontiffs, his successors, and to fight with faithful obedience to God. And whoever much, and however much he may be learned in the gospel, and however he may be taught in the Orthodox faith, let all Christians profess themselves under the Roman pontiff as leader and vicar of Jesus Christ. For the great humility of our society toward the completion of self-mortification of each one, and in each to aid the abnegation of our own souls to the greatest extent, let each one besides that common obligation be devoted to this by special vow. So that whatever the present or other Roman pontiff's order, that concerns the saving of souls and the spread of faith unto whatever provinces he shall wish to send us, this let us strive to accomplish as far as in us lies, without any turning back or excuse. Pretty clear, right? What are they doing? Now the Pope's got to be licking his chops, because basically he has guys swearing in a religious vow that they're going to do whatever he tells them to do. They're going to go where he tells them to go. They're going to do whatever he asks them to do. And the Pope is really having, through the Jesuits, almost the creation of his own little private army of minions that can and will do his bidding wherever he sends them to go. Alright? Now, the Jesuits focused on three main activities. Alright? First, they founded schools throughout Europe. Now, what's the purpose of the schools? To indoctrinate people in Catholic theology. Okay? And possibly also to recruit more Jesuits. The Jesuits' second mission was to convert non-Christians to Catholicism. As we'll see next week, they're very prominent in the Catholic missions of the 15th and 16th century. So they sent missionaries all over the world. The third goal was to stop the spread of Protestantism. The zeal of the Jesuits overcame the drift toward Protestantism in Poland and southern Germany. So because of the efforts of the Jesuits, Protestantism is rolled back in southern Germany and Poland and other areas within Europe because of the force of which these guys went out and tried to carry forth these orders, I guess, for lack of a better term. Now, according to Mark A. Knoll, author of Turning Points, Decisive Moments in the History of Christianity, the founding of the Jesuits was significant for the following three reasons. Okay, number one, the Jesuits would be instrumental in winning Protestant regions back to Rome and solidifying the faith of those in Europe who wavered in their loyalty to the Catholic Church under Protestant influence. So the Jesuits do two things in that capacity. In some cases, they literally roll back the tide of Protestant advances. Number one. Number two, anybody who may have been wavering, whether or not they were toying with Protestantism or whatever, what the Jesuits were able to do is go into those areas and strengthen the conviction of those people toward the Catholic Church and thereby make sure that those regions did not, you know, leave the church, so to speak. Okay? Second, the Jesuits symbolized the strength of what would become traditional Roman Catholicism all the way from the mid-16th century to the mid-20th century. The impact of the Jesuits is going to be felt here for at least 3,000 years. Or 300 years, I'm sorry, not 3,000 years. And third, the missionary zeal of the Jesuits made them an extraordinarily potent force in the history of Christianity. You need to look, folks, why is Mexico, Latin America, and South America all Roman Catholic. Because those regions were originally settled by the Spanish, and when the Spanish came over, they brought with them Jesuit missionaries. And then the Jesuit missionaries are going to go out and spread the Catholic Church, and that's the reason why 98% of Latin America right now is Roman Catholic. So for these three reasons, the Jesuits are significant. Okay. Now, before we move on, is there any questions or comments about this point? Ronnie?
I'm just noticing that they have a very rigorous discipline in this order, and for people that don't actually know the Lord, like the military itself is successful because of the discipline that they have. And so these people probably maintained a higher moral morality than the rest of the Catholic hierarchy had. And so it makes it not as evident to sinful man that these aren't really good, godly people.
And they're following very strictly these disciplines that Ignatius writes down about meditation and so on. And so that they religiously follow these things. They report to the Pope. You know, there's all these things that would, like you say, be attractive to somebody who didn't know any better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Beverly?
Is there much history on the amount of force that they used during the Hairy Adventure?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so much stuff here that we could talk about. But the Jesuits are very prominent in military, the Jesuits were committed to doing whatever was necessary to stop the spread of Protestantism, be it intellectual through the establishment of school, be it military in actually fighting Protestants militarily. These guys are all priests. So, yeah. So they're definitely going to be a force for the Catholics in this Counter-Reformation. Okay? Now, the other thing, how much time do I have left? Because that clock's not working.
It's 9:30.
Okay. As we alluded to earlier, Paul III was Pope between 1534 and 1549. Paul took the following steps in an attempt to reform the Catholic Church. Okay? Number one, he directed a council of cardinals to investigate indulgence selling and other abuses in the church. Alright? He's the guy, number two, that approves the Jesuit order. Alright? Paul III is also going to use the Inquisition to seek out heresy in papal territory. But obviously also with the help of who? The Jesuits, okay? And lastly, he called for a universal church council to address the Protestant challenge. And that universal church council is ultimately going to be the Council of Trent. Now, how many have heard of the Council of Trent? Okay, if you know anything about church history, you've probably at least heard of it. The Council of Trent met in three sessions. All right, at 1545 to 1547, 1551 to 1552, and 1562 to 1563. And it began in early meetings with systematic rebuttals to the main Protestant assertions, and thus may be seen as an engine of counter-reformation. So in each one of these three sessions that they have in the Council of Trent over, you know, over a decade and a half almost, okay, the meetings start with formal rebuttals of the main doctrines of the Protestant reformers. That's where they start, okay? By its last sessions, however, the Council had turned toward the future in drawing up policies and confirming principles that made possible a Catholic expansion more on the foundation of the Church's own internal resources than in reaction to Protestants. So what you need to see here is that if you study the Council of Trent, the Council of Trent is going to unfold in a series of movements. Okay? The first thing they're going to do is the Catholic Church is going to repudiate the doctrines of Luther and Calvin and the Reformers. All right? But then as they move on, they get more toward they're using their own internal power bases to build policies for how they can move forward into the future. So there's a difference between what the Council of Trent is focusing on early on and what they are focusing on later in these meetings. Now, the Council of Trent is going to come to the following conclusions. All right? Now, you need to look at these. Number one, the church's interpretation of the Bible was final. Okay? Any Christian who substituted his or her own interpretation was a heretic. So now I have a question. Was that the same view they had when Luther nailed his theses to the door? So have they really gotten anywhere?
No.
Have they changed anything in that regard? Number two, Christians needed faith and good works for salvation. They were not saved by faith alone, as Luther had argued. So have they really reformed that at all? No. Number three, the Bible and church tradition were equally powerful authorities for guiding Christian life. Is that any different? No. And fourth, indulgences were valid expression of faith, but the false selling of indulgences was banned. So I don't know who determines whether or not they're being sold falsely or not, but so I want you to think about this, those four things. Think about the Reformation, and has the Catholic Church changed anything? All they've done, folks, through the Council of Trent is come out in the most staunchest of stances in favor of their own doctrinal views and positions that they already held before Luther. So is there any real change here in what the church is believing or teaching as far as doctrine and salvation is concerned? No. And if anything, they're doubling down on these things in the Council of Trent.
So who attended the Council of Trent? Was it a local priest?
They were whatever Catholic bishops and clergy were invited to attend throughout Europe. No, there's no reformers invited to the Council of Trent. No.
Okay. I think my Catholic friend said indulgence is a serving practice by the church. I'll have to ask her.
Well,
somehow.
The point I'm getting to is that this Council of Trent became the normative version of Catholicism from the time the Council of Trent ended till almost the Vatican II Council in the 1950s and 60s.
Did they change?
Not much, other than the fact that the Mass didn't have to be done in Latin anymore. Okay.
Vatican II,
right?
Didn't they also say that it doesn't matter what religion you follow, that Christ's grace is, as long as you're sincere in what you believe, basically?
Well, I haven't gotten that far in my reading yet, but you might be right about that. You very well might be right. All I know is that they said that the Mass could be done in the vernacular.
Sure. Yeah.
Norm?
No. Otto told me that, through dealing with Jesuits, that first of all, he said that they gave him a lot of opposition, but he said the other thing, statement they made, that even when he was still in the field, was that anybody that was baptized, whether they're Protestant or Catholic, were claimed by Rome. Have you ever heard that before?
I've heard that before. When I taught, I used to teach a world religion class at the charter school a few years ago before I took my current job, and I would bring in a Catholic priest to talk to the kids about Catholicism, and then I would ask them questions, and the Catholic priest was talking, and he's saying that basically what Craig is saying, that any religion is sort of okay, but the only sure way to know for sure you're going to heaven is if you're Catholic. So they sort of are leaving the door open, but at the same time saying, if you want to be 100% certain, you gotta be a Catholic. And I don't know if that was just something they've come up with recently, or if that was an official ruling of Vatican II. That I don't know. Yeah.
I kind of think that was more recent, but nowadays they call all of us their separated brethren instead of something else.
That's right, Vatican II.
That is okay.
My friend Sebastian Fund, to be with the Lord, and he was born in Germany, and I think he's on record as being a Catholic. I mean, he was a dead grace believer for the last 40 years, but once you're a Catholic and born into the church, they keep track of it.
The last session of the council reaffirmed the counter-reforming canons and decrees of the first two sessions, but also began to chart a course for the Catholic Church oriented more toward its needs for the future than its quarrels with Protestants. Reform under papal leadership went beyond a counter-reformation to positive and constructive efforts at building a more tightly organized, better instructed, and effectively controlled church than the old institution before 1563 had been. It is possible to overstate the unity of Catholic doctrine and practice after the council, but comparatively speaking, Trent brought a higher degree of uniformity than had ever existed within the Western Church. The council's attention to the tasks of the bishops and overseeing the faithful, the spiritual responsibilities of the Pope, and the production of uniform guidelines for liturgy and catechisms, all were factors unifying as well as reforming the church. Now this is the important point I want you to see. Thus set the normative standards for Catholicism until the 20th century. Okay? It was only in the face of changes in geopolitics, intellectual life, population, commerce, and warfare that the Catholic Church would take up the task of modifying the course charted by the Council of Trent. So the Council of Trent is significant from the middle of the 1500s all the way through till about the end of the 1800s, just around the turn of the century when we get into the 20th century. For about 400 years, at least 300 years, the Church is going to dominate through the rulings of the Council of Trent. They're going to become the normative way the Catholic Church is going to function. The next Pope, Pope Paul IV, vigorously carried out the Council's decrees. In 1559, he had officials draw up a list of books considered dangerous to the Catholic faith. This list was known as the Index of Forbidden Books. Catholic bishops throughout Europe were ordered to gather up offensive books, including Protestant Bibles, and burn them in bonfires. In Venice, followers burned 10,000 books in one day. Okay? So, the church is sort of late in taking these measures. But once they do they act fairly decisively in how they respond? Okay? Now, I want to finish. In the 20 minutes we have left, I want to finish by talking about the religious wars and the close of the Reformation. All right? As we have already studied, the religious wars in Germany temporarily ended in 1555 with the Peace of Augsburg. Catholics and Protestants had agreed that the faith of each prince would determine the religion of his subjects. Churches in Germany would be either Lutheran or Catholic, but not Calvinistic. As one might expect, the peace would not last. Okay? We talked about this already a few lessons back, about how the Peace of Augsburg, it said that by the ruler, so went the region. Alright? So if you lived in a territory and the ruler of that region was Catholic, the mandated religion in that region was what? Catholic. So if you didn't like that, if you weren't Catholic, if you wanted something else, you had to walk. You had to move. Okay? According to the Peace of Augsburg. Both Lutheran and Catholic princes tried to gain followers. In addition, both sides felt threatened by Calvinism, which was spreading in Germany and gaining many followers. As tensions mounted, the Lutherans joined together in the Protestant Union in 1608. The following year, the Catholic princes formed the Catholic League. Now, it would take only a spark to set off the war. So now here you have, in essence, two military alliances that have been formed along religious lines. You have the Protestant Union, and you have the Catholic League. The spark here is going to come in 1618. The future Holy Roman Emperor Ferdinand II was head of the Habsburg family, and as such he ruled the Czech Kingdom of Bohemia. The Protestants in Bohemia did not trust Ferdinand, who was a foreigner and a Catholic. When he closed some Protestant churches, the Protestants revolted. Ferdinand sent an army into Bohemia to crush the revolt. Several German Protestant princes took this chance to challenge their Catholic emperor. Okay? Now, this is going to result in what's called the 30 Years' War. Alright? So, thus begins the 30 Years' War, lasting from 1618 to 1648, and it's a conflict over religion and territory and for power among European ruling families. Now, we can talk about this war for an hour just itself, but the war is broken down primarily into two sections, alright? The first section is Habsburg triumphs. This is where the Catholic Habsburg armies from Austria and Spain crush the mercenary troops hired by Protestant princes. So this first section from 1618 to 1630 of the 30 Years' War, is characterized by Catholic victory. Okay? But then something changes in 1630 to 1648. The Protestant king of Sweden. We got some people here from Sweden, don't we, Molly? Okay. The Protestant king of Sweden, Gustavus Adolphus, entered the war and turned the tide in favor of the Protestants. Positioned between Habsburg, Spain, and Austria in 1635, Cardinal Richelieu sent French troops to fight on the side of the Protestants. Now, I want to say something about that. What religion is Cardinal Richelieu? He's Catholic, right? I want you to think for a minute about the geography of Europe. Spain is here, France is here, and Austria is here. Austria is Habsburg. Spain is what? Habsburg. And France is where? Why can the Catholic Cardinal Richelieu not allow the Habsburgs to win? Even though he himself is Catholic. Politics, because who's stuck in the middle? If the Habsburgs win, who's ultimately going to lose? The power of the French king. So what Richelieu does is he enters the Catholics on the side of the Protestants in the 30 Years' War. Not because of religious allegiance, but because he's doing it so he can seek to isolate Austria and Spain and make sure that they what?
Don't overtake him.
That they lose and don't overtake France. You follow that? So here you have a case of the exact opposite, where Catholic France fights on the side of the Protestants, not because Richelieu has any intention of leaving the Catholic Church, but because he fears a union, he fears what's going to happen to France if these two countries what? Win. Yeah.
Now how did Rome feel about that?
Well, Rome didn't necessarily like it, that he would make that decision. Okay. But that's the decision that he made.
Was that real open? I mean, did everybody know that?
Well, everybody knew.
That he was supporting the Protestant troops?
When he decided to do it, everybody knew he was doing it. The Peace of Westphalia in 1648 ended the 30 Years' War. Now, this treaty is significant for the following reasons. Okay. Number one, it weakened the Habsburg faith of Spain and Austria. So did Richelieu and the French get what they wanted out of the war? Yeah, they got a weakened Austria and a weakened Spain. So again, that move is nothing to do with religion. That move is based purely on the politics of the time. Number two, it strengthened France by awarding it German territory. So France, because they fight on the winning side, not only do they get what they want in terms of a weakened Spain and Austria, but they also gain power because when the treaty is drawn up, they're awarded German territories. So the size of France now has what? Has increased. Number three, it made German princes independent of the Holy Roman Emperor. Number four, and this is the last of the religious wars on mainland Europe. Okay?
And most significantly, it abandoned the idea of a Catholic empire that would rule most of Europe. Therefore, it recognized Europe as a group of equal independent states, marking the beginning of the modern state system. So it's going to abandon this idea of Catholic empire that started way back in our lessons with Charlemagne. You remember that? In the Middle Ages, and how Charlemagne was crowned Holy Roman Emperor by the Pope and all that stuff. We talked about that before. Well, that concept of there being a Catholic emperor, empire in Europe is going to last all the way until 1648 when this treaty is drawn up, ending the 30 Years' War. And from then on, you're going to have the emergence of the modern state system in Europe like we have now. Okay? So this whole stream of history is highly significant and highly consequential for a lot of things that are going to happen beyond it, that many of which have nothing to do with religion, specifically. Yeah?
Because then the Peace of Westphalia happened and the Roman See went ahead and approved it, that set aside the Jesuits from their attacks on the...
No. It didn't stop any of that. The Jesuits still went after Protestants. You know. But, Lolly, if you think back to an earlier point I made today, what it did do,
even though they lost, was Spain still Catholic? Was France still Catholic? Was Austria still Catholic? So religiously, does Rome lose any ground?
No,
the individual Catholic states and the idea of a massive Roman Catholic empire, that is going to sort of fall by the wayside. But all of these countries, these three big countries here, are still going to remain fully Catholic. Okay.
Now, it's my own personal opinion now. I believe that the Peace of Westphalia marks the official end of the Protestant Revolution. When we began our discussion of the Protestant Revolution, we were using the following definition by Jacques Barzum: the violent transfer of power and property in the name of an idea. Okay? In modern times, Western society uses the term revolutionary too loosely. Whenever a new technology, gadget, or practice hits the market that changes our domestic habits or makes life a little easier, the culture screams revolutionary. Unfortunately, this literal use of the word has detracted from its true meaning. When something is truly revolutionary, it changes more than our personal habits or widespread practice. True revolutions give culture a new face. Okay? According to Barzum, it is incorrect to view the Protestant Revolution as merely religious in nature. I want to read to you this quote here. To call the first of the four revolutions religious is also inadequate. It did indeed cause millions to change the forms of their worship and their conception of their destiny, but it did much besides. It posed the issue of diversity of opinion as well as faith. It fostered new feelings of nationhood. It raised the status of the vernacular languages. It changed attitudes toward work and human failing. It deprived the West of an ancestral sense of unity and common descendancy. Lastly, but less immediately, by immigration to the New World overseas, it brought an extraordinary enlargement of the means of West and the power of its civilization. So, the effects here of the change, this religious shakeup in Europe, are going to have far-reaching consequences beyond just the religious doctrine and theology. Okay? That's the main point here. Protestant theology provided the philosophical justification for the formation of new political structures that would break with Roman Catholicism and assert their own autonomy. The new religious ideas that were being articulated by Martin Luther and others gave the German princes an ideological justification for breaking with Roman Catholics and increasing their own power. The net effect of these changes was that, as advertised by Barzum, the cultural and political landscape of Europe was permanently altered. And the last point here, religion, nationalism,
tumultuous new patterns of economic life, as well as a broad intellectual upheaval, were all advanced before the appearance of Protestantism. In the larger sphere of European history, Protestantism acted as an accelerator for forces of development that were already well on their way by 1517 and Martin Luther's posting of the 95 Theses. Now what this guy is saying is that the main forces are already in play here, and Martin Luther just took gas and dumped it on it and made it accelerate. One of them is political. Protestantism would require local leaders or urban councils with the ability to act self-confidently and with a fair measure of independence. You didn't have to rely on who anymore. The Pope and the Catholic Church structure. Nationalism, concentrations of power around a central monarchical house, also took place in lands that would remain substantially Catholic. Although patterns of centralized national authority differed radically among European nations, the general trend in each of these areas was toward greater concentration of political power, pointing them toward the modern nation state. So in other words, Rome losing out as a political power now? They were the power. Remember when we talked about the Middle Ages, we said that the church was the state. Okay? After the Protestant Revolution, not so anymore. The church is still a strong religious force and still sought to manipulate and control the politics, but people had largely broken free from the stranglehold of Rome over their political futures. And the last one is economic. Okay? Forces at work in European economic life were also moving toward greater local vitality and less autocratic deference to a central religious authority. The main economic point that needs to be stressed is not any simple equation between an increase of trade and a rise of Protestantism. Rather, it is that Europe's economic recovery created new centers of financial power, new situations for potential friction, friction, and new opportunities for fiscal resentment. Those new situations were stirring the pot of traditional European allegiances in both church and state well before the potent ingredient of Protestant theology was added to the brew. Okay? Now what I want you to see in this class, hopefully, yes, I want you to see the history of the church, but I also want you to hopefully give you even just a greater view and understanding of history on the big scale of what is going on here. Okay? Now we have about 5 minutes left. Are there any questions or comments? Linda?
What is God's plan for sovereignty of nations today? Is that God's plan for a nation to be sovereign so we all... One crash, one hole.
Well, God instituted nationalism way back in Genesis 10 and 11.
So, is it reinforcing now? It looks like to keep everybody free as an advancement, right? I mean, it seems like you could think now. And then if your king goes one way, you can maybe next king will go the other.
I'm a little confused by exactly what you're asking me, but...
United States is standing alone. They can't tell us what to do.
Yeah, well, that's nationalism.
That's national.
That's the idea that... Go to Genesis. Go to Genesis 10. Go to Genesis 10, verse 5. Now you remember that the flood happens, right? And Noah and his family get off the ark, and what does God tell them? Scatter, replenish, refill what? The earth, right? Now what does man do? In direct disobedience to that
commandment, they all gather into one in one place, right? At Babel in Genesis chapter 11. So what you're reading here in Genesis chapter 10, in my opinion, actually happened subsequent or after Genesis 11, and I'll show you why. Look at Genesis 11 verse 1 first. And the whole earth was of one language and of one what? Speech. So, in that point, is there anybody speaking any different languages? No. Look at verse 7. Let us go down and confound their language, that they may not understand one another's what. So that's where God comes down and He separates, He confounds their language, and that's where you have the origin of all the languages, correct? Now look, go back to chapter 10, look at verse 5. It says, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his what?
Tongue.
After their families in their what?
Nations.
Okay? Now obviously if he's dividing them there according to their tongues, when did that division have to happen? It had to happen after the Tower of Babel, right? Because when Genesis 11 starts, the whole earth is of one language and of what? One speech, and there's not a confounding of the tongues until you get to verse 7. But then in chapter 10, verse 5, you have the account of God dividing them, everyone in their tongue, after their families, in their what? Nations. Look at verse 20. These are the sons of Ham. Notice, after their families, after their what? Tongues, in their countries, and in their what? Nations. Verse 31. These are the sons of Shem, after their families, after their tongues, in their lands, and in their what? Nations. These are the families of the sons of Noah, verse 32, after their generations, in their nations. Notice, and by these were the nations divided in the earth when? After the flood. Now, when, this is a very interesting point, when Europeans, I got to make this point quick. When Europeans show up to the New World, what do they find amongst the Native Americans? How are the Native Americans living? Are they living exactly the way this passage says they are? Are they divided in North and South America according to language? And are they also divided into nations? Yes. And so when the European explorers first encounter the Native Americans, they encounter a societies of people that are divided in the earth exactly the way Genesis 10 said God divided them. And when they went to war with each other, they were national wars. The Iroquois nation against whatever nation or what have you, because that's the way God set it up. Now, over time, through military conquest and other things, have national boundaries and borders shifted and so on and so forth. But my point is that originally, this is the way God divided people in the earth. Okay? Now, Ronnie, you had one question. I got time for one question, then we got to go.
This isn't a question. It's just a New Testament verse about nationalism. Mark 13:8. For nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom.
There's no doubt that that's the way God wanted man to function in the earth. And by the way, that's why, for me personally, I don't view human government as its own dispensation.
And two, God had a purpose in dividing the nations. In Acts it says that, and hath made of one blood all nations of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitations, so that's when you divide them up, that they should seek after the Lord, if haply they might find him.
Yes.
So because they so corrupted what they were supposed to be doing in Babel, God separated them with some knowledge of truth still, but they would hope to seek after the Lord.
There's more going on in Genesis 10, I believe, than just the dividing of the people. I think God is also dividing the land. I think He's literally splitting the land up and arranging the isles of the Gentiles. We don't have time to get into that today. Maybe we can have a sub-study on that sometime in the future. But I definitely believe that that's what's going on here. And with the verse Craig quoted from Acts, when he says that he determined the bounds of their habitation, what he literally did is put them in a piece of land and said, okay, this land here is yours. And then he said, run it. And then all these different nations that he puts in the earth with specific lands that have been given to him, then, being that man is the way man is, what do they start to do? Well, you know what? I just don't think we have enough land. So I think we need to do what? We need to send a raiding party over that boundary and get some of their land. Right? Yeah, they have better grass or whatever. Yeah.
So are you alluding to that you think that's on the continent?
Yes. That's exactly what I'm alluding to.
If you look at the earliest civilization, they're spread out all over the world, but they're in a really narrow band.
Yes.
So they all started out in one place. But
sorry we don't have more time to get into that, but we definitely got to quit or we won't start church on time. Thanks for your attention. Next week we'll talk about becoming, how the religion came over to the New